Okay. I will speak about a new approach to numerical relativity. Actually, it's not that new, namely the conformal approach. And I hope I can convince you that one can do 3D numerical relativity without the need to introduce artificial boundaries. And the stuff I'm talking about, the numerical stuff, has mainly been written by myself recently. That means last year, Marsha Weaver joined me and has now contributed to writing the code. Of course, I had a lot of support from the analytic side by Helmut Friedrich and Bernd Schmidt, and I had a lot of discussions with Jörg Frauendiener also. So first, I would like to describe some key properties of the conformal field equations which are used in this approach in a very essential way. I will describe the numerical implementation of A, the time integration, and B, the constraint solver. And in the third thing, I will describe one example I have calculated. I will give first a list of what has been done to test the code and which calculations have been performed. And then I have to say something about how we extract physical quantities before I can talk about Kurzweil-Schwarzschild or how I calculate the space-time. And then I will end with a conclusion. I should say that Jörg Frauendiener has a 2D code for which many of the statements I will make also apply. And of course, they also apply to my old 1D code. So what are the properties of the conformal field equations? So first thing we have to do is to write the conformal field equations, which are tensorial equations, as a first-order system which has a nice form to be discretized. And I do so here only for the vacuum field equation. And I do so by introducing a set of variables that are H, the 3 metric of a hypersurface, and K, its extrinsic curvature. And in the conformal approach, you have, in addition, the conformal rescaling factor omega and its time derivative. Then all the higher derivatives which are appearing here also, they all have geometric interpretation, are in a certain sense auxiliary variables to make the system well posed. And the variables are the 3 connection, the 9 components of the trace-free part of the Ricci tensor, the electric and magnetic part of the Weyl tensor. So if you have those as variables and you want to read off radiation, you don't have to differentiate anymore. You only have to do it to calculate the initial variables. And you have higher derivatives of the conformal factor. And of course, to make the system well-posed, one also needs to fix the gauge, and I do that by prescribing 5 gauge source functions. That is a combination of laps over the square root of the determinant of the 3 metric by giving shift, and this is in addition to normal approaches by giving the Ricci scalar. The Ricci scalar fixes the gauge freedom one has when one goes from the physical to the conformal space-time. If we do so, we obtain a system of equations which consists of a set of symmetric hyperbolic time evolution equations. They are quasi-linear, and those matrices here depend on the 4 metric GAB, which is constructed in the usual way from laps, shift, and the 3 metric. There's also...
How are they fixed?
I give those as 3 functions of space and time.
So you choose some function of the coordinates and
Yeah.
You don't have a separate differential.
No, I prescribe them. Yeah. There's also a huge set of constraints, of first-order constraints, which involves the 3 metric first derivatives of the variable, which are equal to some right-hand side. R is the Ricci scalar of the conformal space-time. Of the four-dimensional conformal space-time. The hat here is just that's the trace-free part of the Ricci tensor. So these are 9 components And the tenth component of the Ricci tensor is the Ricci scalar.
And all of this is in the unphysical space?
That's all in the unphysical space. But at the moment, I just have a system of differential equation, and I will come to the interpretation later. So you may be interested, if I do so, how do the equations look like? And I would like to say a little bit more about the detail. The equations look very familiar, namely they are very closely related to the Maxwell equations, and in a certain sense they are a quasi-linear generalization of the Maxwell equations. So you have a part which describes the time evolution of the electric and magnetic field, which is just rotation of the fields itself, and then here we have a bunch of nonlinear terms. Because the nonlinear terms involve potentials, we need differential equations which give the potentials, namely the potentials are K and gamma, and those equations are written here. And because of the quasi-linearity, which is hidden here in the epsilon and in the space-like derivative, I also need an equation which gives me a time evolution for the three metric, and that's just the definition of the extrinsic curvature. There are also additional equations which describe the conformal part of the equation, because if I do the same split, I can also do that for the Einstein equations. Those here are 42 variables so far, and if I add the conformal freedom, I get 15 more variables. Actually, I've forgotten one thing. This here just comes from the Bianchi identities of the Weyl tensor. The constraints also look like the one we have in Maxwell's equation. Namely, we have a number of constraints telling what the divergence of the electric and magnetic field are. There are nonlinear terms here, though it's not vanishing. And there are a number of constraints which tell us that the electric and the magnetic field are related to the skew derivatives of the potentials. There is this relation which just tells me that the derivatives of the three metric are related to the three connection. And we have constraints for the conformal factor and the trace free part of the Ricci tensor, of course. I just want to point out, if I'm in physical space-time, I can directly calculate D and E from this equation if I have K and H, by doing this differentiation numerically. In the conformal space-time, to get E and B, which are the components of the conformally rescaled Weyl tensor, I have to divide by omega here. But that's the only place in the whole game where I have to divide by omega. And that was a little bit tricky to do that, because omega is zero in our setup at certain grid points. So what kind of initial value problem will I consider? I am going to consider what is called the extended hyperboloidal initial value problem. That means I give data in such a way that this is my grid here covering a part of the initial hypersurface, and omega is given in such a way that it is smaller zero near the grid boundary, positive somewhere inside, and then it serves of course a boundary. I furthermore require that the four vector of omega is future directed, and that the constraints are fulfilled on this blue and green part. For reasons which will become clear later, I call this blue-green part the physical part of the grid, this red part the unphysical part of the grid. So now, let's assume we take initial data, extended hyperboloidal initial data set, and solve the evolution equations. What do we get? First, I want to emphasize this again. This problem is well-defined because the evolution equations are the metric hyperbolic. Then, if we have constructed the four metric from a solution of the evolution equations, we know that tilde g, which is defined to be omega to the minus 2 gab, is a solution of the vacuum Einstein field equations on the region where omega is larger than zero. Of course, this metric here becomes infinite at omega equals zero, that suggests that this omega equals zero is infinitely far away. And indeed, if one calculates null geodesics of the physical metric, they intersect this surface here at infinite affine parameter, so this is really null infinity. Actually, this is kind of technical restriction. Then we also know that if we have solved our evolution equations, then in the region where omega is larger or equal to zero, the solution does not depend neither on the data nor on what we do with the equations in the unphysical part. That will be very essential for the outer boundary problem. The one restriction is, of course, the equations should be modified in such a way that they stay hyperbolic. But that's the only restriction. And furthermore, I want to point out that for the conformal field equations, there is nothing special about this hypersurface here, this surface here where omega vanishes. It's only the physical interpretation of the metric we have calculated which makes this a special surface.
Because we're guaranteed that in the solution where omega is zero, there will be no
value. No, actually, if I solve initial data which belong, for example, to Minkowski, then there will be a point where this breaks down, and this is then future time-like infinity. So if this is not fulfilled here, then the interpretation is no longer necessary null infinity. I don't know whether it still can be, but I do not expect it to be. It can't, okay. So now we have set up the analytic framework, and now...
It can't be null infinity, that's for sure. But
pardon?
It doesn't have to be, you know, hyper-tire.
Yeah.
So when I, of course, I have, when I do a numerical integration, I have to do the same two steps as everyone here, namely, I first have to calculate data by solving the constraints, and second, I have to do a numerical time integration. I will start by describing what I do to do the numerical time evolution, because that's the easier part, and that part is essentially finished. So how do I do the numerical time evolution? So what I do is I use a fourth order method of line. And in a fourth order method of line, one formally writes the partial differential equations as ordinary differential equations. That means I say that dt of f is some right-hand side, and this right-hand side now depends on the space-like derivatives of f, of course. And in addition, one adds some dissipative term here. This set of equations then is integrated by using an integrator for ordinary differential equations. In my case, I use a usual fourth-order Runge-Kutta scheme. And this here, to obtain fourth order in space also, I differentiate this here with a fourth-order stencil. To obtain numerical stability, you have to add the dissipative term here. And what is suggested by theorems I will cite in a minute is that you use the sixth derivative of the f's here and multiply it by the grid size to the fifth power. This sigma here, how much dissipation I add, is one parameter. There's a second one. There's the CFL condition, which tells me essentially that the allowed time step for this explicit method is restricted by 1 over c times the space step, and depending on what stencil you use for differentiation, you get a certain factor here. And if the CFL condition would be the only condition required for stability, in my case, Q could be up to 12. It will be much smaller for getting stability. So what do I know about stability of this method? There are essentially two theorems which tell me that everything I'm doing is perfectly correct. The first is by Gustafson, Kreis, and Oliger, which tells me that for any symmetric hyperbolic system with constant coefficients, there exists choices of Q and sigma such that the scheme is stable, if this scheme I just described. Which I should make two remarks. The first is that if you use stronger fields in the sense that you have more nonlinearity in the equation, whatever that means, you have to increase the dissipation and you have to decrease the Q. That's something which in principle can be calculated, what values are allowed, but it's just easier to make a try, and if it doesn't work, you increase the sigma and reduce the Q. For the advection equation, that is dt of f equals dx of f, you just have sigma is equal 0 and q is equal 2.06. And so that's probably upper boundary for what you can do. Okay, that's now for constant coefficient. We have a quasi linear system. There's a second theorem by Kreis, which is actually very old, which says that for a symmetric hyperbolic system, theorem 1 implies local nonlinear stability. And that is the optimum you can get. You can prove that if you want to remove this local here, the theorem can no longer be true by giving counterexamples, at least for the Einstein equation. So, of course, also we have to say how we deal with the grid boundaries. And I said that I can modify the equation there. And it's causally disconnected from the interior of the space-time. So I just want to say here that there are a number of things you can do, and they give you a long-term evolution which is consistent with the Einstein equation. That means what you get on the omega larger than zero grid points is, in the limit of finite grid size, a solution of the Einstein equation, no matter how long you integrate. I have also performed a comparison of the fourth order method I use on a number of space-times which contain gravitational radiation, and I see that the fourth order method are much, much more efficient than the second order method. I don't want to discuss this table in full detail. I just want to point out one thing. If one does a 100 cube run in 3D, then with the second order method and on that exact solution, I get a relative error. So that means error over the maximal value of the function by approximately 6%. That's maximum norm. But the same applies for the L2 norm. And in the fourth order scheme, I get 2 times 10 to the minus 1%. Both schemes are in the regime already where the local truncation error is the leading error in the convergence. So you can extrapolate this, and you see that in the second order scheme, you would need about 500 cube grid points. This means that the fourth order scheme, as the second order schemes, requires about 100 times the memory and about 500 times the actual calculation time than the fourth order scheme. So, I have forgotten the most important point, actually. Yeah. The time integration scheme, as I already said, is completely insensitive to where the boundary where omega equals zero lies. So for the time integration scheme, there is no difference whether I take the situation sketched on the first picture or whether I make a hole in it with another omega equals zero boundary or more and more. Of course, if you punch 10 holes in it, you need more resolution, but that is clear because you have more structure in the solution. We will come to that kind of space-time later, so that's of course an initial slide. Okay, so how do we solve the constraints? And that's now kind of tricky. Also, we have a lot of theorems telling that solutions exist. But what one would like to do is to solve the conformal constraints directly, because then we would not need to do this division by omega. But that's not possible. There are general arguments that what you get is cannot be smooth. So we construct our initial data set in three steps. First is we construct what I will call a minimal set of data. That means a three-metric extrinsic curvature, omega, and the time derivative of omega on the physical part of the grid. I will use the remaining conformal constraints to extend this minimal set of data to a full set of data, and in the third step I extrapolate smoothly to an extended hyperboloidal initial data set. I should say that step 2 and 3 can be implemented in a way which is independent of the topology of the region with omega larger 0 or of the topology of the boundary. Of course, the code for 1 depends on the topology. At least I don't know of any way right now to make it independent of the topology. I have, up to the moment, I have written a constraint solver for what is called asymptotically A3 spacetimes. That is the simplest case, because there you can arrange that the boundary is on grid, lies on grid points. And the asymptotically A3 spacetimes are spacetimes which have a toroidal scry, or two toroidal scries. They are interesting because they are an excellent toy model in the sense that you can do 2D calculations, that means one killing vector, without having to deal with with instabilities on the axis, because those spacetimes don't have an axis. They are like Schwarzschild. Schwarzschild is spherical symmetric but doesn't have a center. And furthermore, they are locally very similar, even on scry, than asymptotically flat spacetimes. Only globally they differ. So how do I construct a minimal set of data? And that is will be very familiar to most of us, to most of you, because that's essentially similar to what all people do. So we make a Lichnerowitz-like ansatz. That means, and now we work in physical space-time for a moment. That means we take a hypersurface which has constant trace of extrinsic curvature. We cannot set it to zero because we want to have hyperboloidal surfaces, and which are surfaces which go to null infinity, and they cannot have k equals zero. We set the trace of the extrinsic curvature to be zero, and we make an ansatz for our metric, which is some gas metric, HAB, times an omega bar, which is a boundary-defining function, divided by some conformal factor to this square. Then this ansatz solves the Hamiltonian constraints automatically, and the vector constraint, and the Hamiltonian constraint transforms to an equation which is called Yamabe equation in the mathematical literature. This equation is an elliptic equation, except that the principal part vanishes at the boundary. That means where omega vanishes. There are theorems which tell us that there exists a unique solution with positive phi. There's one speciality for this equation. If you want to have a smooth phi, you immediately see that those terms which can contain derivatives drop out. Therefore, this expression here gives you the value of phi on the boundary, so you are not allowed to describe boundary values. Then, after we have solved the Yamabe equation, the conformal the corresponding conformal quantities can be constructed by giving an extrinsic curvature free in the conformal spacetime, taking the tracery part of the extrinsic curvature to be zero. HAB is a three metric, is just this guy here. Omega is just this factor here, and omega zero is defined by this relation here. I should say that there is a small restriction on HAB which we have to satisfy to be able to divide by omega later on. No, it's not. It's the only thing is that you know, you need to ensure that you know where the omega is equal to zero, because there you have to give the boundaries values from this expression here. So you need to have knowledge about where that is.
So this, you're doing this independent of how many holes there are?
No, as I said, at the moment, this you can use for as many holes you have. But at the moment, I have only implemented it for the simple cases.
But what would the strategy be for the case of more than one hole? Like, for instance, you wouldn't want to put KAB to even more, presumably.
Actually, you can relax those conditions here and get then four differential equations to be solved. I have not completely studied the literature, but I think Lars knows better, but for most cases you know existence, I guess.
Okay, the question was more numerical interpretation, so you have not looked at that yet?
I have looked at it, and I have a very well-defined strategy, and I think I know what to implement. I just have not started to implement it. I would use a finite element method to just be able to place the boundary where I want and solve then the elliptic equation with finite elements. And the rest I will speak about in a minute. So how do I solve the elliptic equation now for the simple case? What I do is I combine what is called a Richardson iteration with algebraic multigrid techniques and pseudo-structural techniques. That means I want to solve an equation of the kind elliptic operator applied on phi is equal to some nonlinear term. And then I make an ansatz which tells me that the new, hopefully better approximation to the solution is the old approximation plus some correction, and I have to multiply it by a factor. And the correction I get from linearizing this equation, which just tells me, take this elliptic operator, which is now linear, on this perturbation and set it to the value of this, to the failure of the old elliptic equation. That's just a standard technique. You have to invert this elliptic operator here, and I do that by algebraic multigrid techniques. I got the library from Klaus Stüben, who has specialized on elliptic operators, and to calculate this, I use pseudo-spectral techniques. That means we have heard about it. I make a Fourier transformation or Chebyshev transformation to calculate the derivatives here. What you get by combining those is a Yamabe solver of what is called formally infinite order. That just means if you increase the number of collocation points in the game or the number of base functions, you also increase the order of your scheme. I should say that those two parts are certainly state of the art for elliptic equation. There is certainly some space for improvement, but so far I had no problems with it. That was how I solved the Yamabe equation. Then, that is just by trial and error, because if you use a too large epsilon, the scheme becomes unstable, and so I just went ahead and reduced the epsilon until I see that the solution converges. It's in my case, in 3D, it's 1/8, and in 2D, it's 1/4 what you need. So there's a theory for it. In principle, you could calculate the epsilon. I was just too lazy. Yeah, kind of. But if I use larger epsilons, the scheme is not stable. So. Okay, then the next step is I have to extend to a full set of data, and I do that by using the constraints for the remaining unknowns, F1, and there are also quantities H, which are omega times the alpha unknowns. Then I calculate this H over omega to determine F2 by solving a linear elliptic equation which has the same principal part as the Hammabe equation. And this gives me a smooth error. But otherwise, if I use just this rule here in the interior and L'Hopital's rule on the boundary, I don't get a smooth discretization error, and which would make this boundary visible to the discretization scheme. Then there's the third part that...
So far you extended everything in omega bigger than zero.
Yeah, that's for omega, for the physical part only. And now I have to extend smoothly. I said that when I extend smoothly, I don't have to satisfy the constraints outside. And I do that by, yeah, just smoothly, smooth extrapolation. Unfortunately, what you would think of in a primitive way is numerically unstable, because smoothly extending data means essentially solving the Cauchy problem for an elliptic equation. This is known to be unstable, so you have to make the procedure stable. In the code I have now, I use the spectral coefficients, modify my spectral bases, which are Chebyshev polynomials, in such a way that I can do that smoothly. That, of course, because the spectral basis I have to use depends on the topology. The whole procedure here depends on the topology. You can also, which is studied in the literature, use linear programming techniques, which would be topology independent, to do this smooth extrapolation.
It's not like a Cauchy problem.
It's actually, you solve here the Cauchy problem for the for the elliptic equation, and as everybody probably knows, is the Cauchy problem is stable for analytic functions, but it's unstable for C infinity function. And these linear programming techniques allow you to reduce the solution space to really to the analytic functions and take out the C infinity functions. So now I can, time to come to the examples. And so first, list of examples which have been used for calculations. There's first, of course, the list of examples where you know the full analytic solution. That means data plus gate source functions. Those are Minkowski space. It's this R3 space, which is in a certain sense like Schwarzschild, but not with S2 as the killing orbit, but a two-dimensional torus as the killing orbit. And there is this class of A3-like solutions, which have the same topology than the A3 solution, but which contain gravitational radiation. They also have two killing vectors. In the cosmological context, those are known as polarized Gaudi spacetime. Then there is this the example I'm going to speak about for a while, the Schwarzschild spacetime. For those, we only know the data in an explicit form. So we are more or less in the same situation than getting data from a Yamada solver. We have also performed numerical runs with data which came from the Yamada solver. That means 2D asymptotically A3 solutions and 3D asymptotically A3 solutions. So when you do the first calculation in 2 or 3D, you're immediately faced with that you get a bunch of numbers and you don't know what they really mean. So you have to do some interpretation, which I call here extract physics. For example, a question one would like to ask is, what energy is radiated into a certain direction per proper time of the observer? That what would be measured by a gravitational wave detector. The main tool for answering many of these questions is that I'm able to integrate future-directed curves and transport equation along those curves. For example, I have implemented this now and built into the fourth order scheme that both together runs in parallel. So the time evolution solver plus the integration of the geodesics, and I can calculate now world lines of observers and the proper time along them, null geodesics to determine the causal connections of the space-time and to see what the space-time looks like, or bonding systems on scribe. That means those are we needed to extract gravitational radiation. For calculating bonding systems on scribe, you have to go to a conformal rescaling in which scribe is expansion-free. I do that by setting up the initial data in such a way that scribe is a unit sphere or a unit torus initially. We have the freedom in the Yamabe solver, because essentially the Yamabe equation is just the equation one usually needs to solve to make scribe this unit sphere. And then, after we have done that, we keep track of the change of the conformal rescaling, which maps our conformal metric to the metric in which scribe stays the unit sphere or the unit torus. Then, after we have done this, and transported the frames which define the detector along the geodesics, we can read off the size, which, for example, psi 4 defines the gravitational radiation. We can read off bonding time and bonding mass. Another quantity which we will need in the Schwarzschild case is to be able to extract the curvature invariance. For vacuum spacetimes, there are four curvature invariants. That is the real and the complex part of I and J. And I is defined to be the square of the Y spinor, which is in our variables just E square minus B square plus imaginary unit times E times B. And J is just a combination of B and A to the third power. So the corresponding physical quantities are easily obtained by multiplying the invariant built from the conformal Y tensor by omega to the 6 for I and omega to the 9 for J. Those factors here are the Peeling theorem. Okay, so let's discuss Schwarzschild. So Schwarzschild in the conformal picture looks like this. Probably, I hope everyone has seen that. We have a white hole singularity sitting down here, a black hole singularity sitting here. According to cosmic censorship, they are both space-like hypersurfaces. And we have an event horizon here for this future null infinity, and you have an event horizon here for the other future null infinity. Okay, now, by putting in time-like geodesics, there are a number of different time-like geodesics. There are time-like geodesics which come out at the throat of this white hole singularity and run into the black hole singularity, and I just want to mention that, which will become important later, the proper time which has elapsed from here to here is just pi in our unit. There are other geodesics which run like this. There are geodesics which come from past time-like infinity and go to future time-like infinity. And if we place those geodesics at larger and larger area distance from the throat, we get curves like this, which asymptotically go to scribe. And an observer sitting at infinity moves from I0 up here. This is scribe plus, because we have null geodesics end here. And space-like geodesics go end at this point, therefore this is space-like infinity. So our hyperboloidal slices lie in the picture as follows. So we have a hypopoloidal slice, which looks like this here, and I should emphasize it should be space-like everywhere. We do some time evolution for some time and get a hypopoloidal slice like this here. The data we will see later start at a proper time, which is about 3/4 away from the throat here. So they really start that deep in the conformal diagram. Now, we have, if we do a calculation like this, there's this question, how much of the space-time have we covered by our calculation? One way to measure this is certainly to put null geodesics on the grid points here, make them outward going, and just measure how many null geodesics here have reached scry. That means, in other words, we want to see what part of the space-time can be probed by our numerical calculation. So I mean that I want to do a picture which looks like this. So here that are the null geodesics, and of course this is also a null geodesic, which should never reach scry in a regular point. Now, there are also a number of other measures. For example, one could measure the proper time which has elapsed for an observer going from this hypersurface to this hypersurface. If we do this and make the limit of the observer going to infinity, we get a finite value, namely, this is just the Bondi time here. There are other measures. For example, one could measure the proper time which passes when going from the hypersurface to the event horizon. And now something happens, because if we do this and take the limit outwards, there's no finite limit anymore. That means all these times are finite, but the time for an observer here is infinite. That is just the expression for the fact that this is time like infinity. Now, if one wants to compare with other people's calculation, one first has to look what are the hypersurfaces other people, so the usual 3+1 approach, calculate. And in this picture, the hypersurface look as follows. So you have a hypersurface here which goes to I 0, space like infinity, and all other hypersurfaces do that as well. That means in the conformal diagram they look like this. And I think from this diagram it's already very clear that questions like how does the grid behave under time evolution are completely different. That's just something you have to measure here, how much proper time has passed. So if you put an observer here, you can measure the proper time here. And I don't know. That's a very formal picture here at the moment. So so now one could also ask what happens if I measure the proper time elapsed between the yellow hypersurface and the hyperboloidal surface. And this is finite here, but if I go to infinity, this becomes infinite, which just expresses the fact that the hyperboloidal surface, which approaches a null surface far out, is infinitely far away from a space-like surface. And that, so this piece here would be fine, is finite as we have seen, but this piece here makes an infinite contribution to the time elapsed. So now the question is, I have this nice diagram. We know it has certain topology, I want to represent it on a cubic grid, which is easy to discretize with a finite difference method. So what we know is, if this is our hyperboloidal slice, each yellow point in this diagram is in reality a sphere. So what we do is, we take a cubic grid like here, we have an inner boundary sky, which corresponds to this sky here, we have an outer boundary sky, which corresponds to this sky here, and we have the yellow point here representing this sphere here in the diagram. I should say, it's if you're here inside this line, you have to modify the data to get a regular center in for the conformal metric. But we are allowed to do that because that is in the unphysical part of the grid. And the physical part of the grid is this part in between the shells. Okay.
Why not do it on a cylindrical topology instead with the three typically described thing?
We did that. That's the A3. You may talk about that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go now to the actual calculation. And what I've plotted here is a run where I gave data on the hypersurface here. I only plot the radial direction because the whole picture is spherical symmetric. That does the conformal field equations.
Right, but there's no problem about this discretizing.
No, that is the method of line which I use for discretizing. That's the fourth order scheme. So what I do here, and that is a picture of a 100 cube run, what I do here is I give data here, and this is the right sky, and this is the left sky, and I guess some gauge source functions. I have to guess them because I don't know them. So we only have explicit representation of the data, and what you see here is that the right sky looks different, so the outer sky from the inner sky. That is just an effect of the gauge source function. In this diagram, all these dotted lines are null geodesics, which start of all grid points of a 50 cube run. So that is the run with the lowest resolution I did. This red line here is the event horizon for the inner sky, and this is the event horizon for the outer sky. And what you now see is that, of course, these null geodesics, which are very far outside, have reached sky in this calculation, but you also see that all initially placed null geodesics in this calculation have reached sky here. So, in a certain sense, I could cover most of the future of the initial slice of this calculation. One must emphasize that whatever you do, there will always be a small stripe here between the event horizon and what you can cover by a finite calculation, because the I plus for Schwarzschild is a singular point, so you can never really cover it with the grid. Those event horizons, so those here are calculated because I know the curvature invariance, so I can locate the event horizon on the initial slice, and then this is just the null geodesic which follows this line. I will speak about the error in a minute, so the error I get for this calculation. Now there's the question, why do I stop? And the point is just, when I do different runs, I can do the calculation for a different amount of time steps. In the 50 cube run, the calculation stops at this slice here because the metric in the outer, in the unphysical part of the space-time is no longer represented accurately enough. So what happens here is that the positive definite metric becomes negative definite. So that's just the code stop. So I do the same run with 100 cube, and because I have a fourth order scheme, that means my accuracy is by a factor of 16 higher, and in this calculation I come up here, and now I can catch all null geodesics. By doing a 125 cube run, which doubles the resolution, I can go even a piece farther. And all these runs did stop in because something was happening in the outside. That means in principle I could just go ahead here and throw away what I have calculated here, replace it by something new which makes sense and continue. But that is not something which is easy to do. It's just you have to sit down and do it, which is like always a lot of work in the numerics. I should also say in this picture, as you already see, this is a run with shift equals zero and Q some value, which pushes the time evolution in this region here. We know that for the conformal field equations, we have almost full control over the location of scry in certain representations. We have even full control over the location of scry and keep the nice properties of the evolution equations. That means we can control the location of scry and have symmetric hyperbolic systems, at least in some representations. So we can arrange matters by giving an appropriate shift that scry just moves up on straight lines. So we wouldn't lose grid points. Also, in this calculation, we have already seen certain effects of the choose of our choice of the Ricci scalar. But I don't want to speak about this. Yeah, exactly. And especially this solution we have given is for numerical purposes a very ugly, the initial data are very ugly, because on the initial slide the light cones have eccentricity of 10. That means if you look on the light cones from above, in Minkowski case, in normal coordinates you just get the circle here. In the coordinates I have in Schwarzschild, I get an ellipsoid which looks like this, and this is about 1 and this is about 10. And this is actually the thing which enforces us to use very small time steps because of this large anisotropy in the propagation of light. This, of course, can be changed by doing a coordinate transformation on the initial slice, and we are working on doing this. One should say that the data were available to us on December the 15th. So the calculations which have been performed is work which has done essentially up to New Year's Day. Now,
So on the initial slice, you use some analytic data.
Yeah.
And you discretize that.
Yeah.
And your choice of Lachen shift doesn't follow, the physical region doesn't follow the kinesthetic.
No, we guess lapse and shift. Yeah. So it, in a certain sense, that is the situation we would be faced with in a more general situation where we have a Schwarzschild black hole with radiation on it. And I must emphasize, in this case, we never used anything special in the sense that we used an event horizon boundary, apparent horizon boundary condition or anything like this. So one can expect that the same calculation carries through in a similar way in more complicated situations where, for example, if you have two holes into the slice, which one can convince oneself by thinking a little bit, contains this certain situation with two black holes.
What you got? You got to guess the Ricci scalar and the Lachen.
Yeah, all five gauge source functions. None is known.
What, can you say just two sentences about
how you this run here has been performed with a Ricci scalar of 6. I used no shift, so 0. And the Q has the following form. It's Q is the logarithm of lapse over square root of the determinant of H. And the Q has a form like this, which has a certain extrema at the place where that is about here, the sky flattens down. The Q here was chosen in such a way to go as far as possible on the outer sky. If you want to push time evolution in the interior, you would choose a different Q which is accelerating time evolution here. So now the question is, how close are we now to I plus? And the answer to this is that you look at the Bondi time of the observer. So the line here is the Bondi time. There are interruptions here which come because this calculation was done in steps. So this is always an 8-hour job here. And so that is, I do not output every grid point, so that's why you have the interruptions here. What you clearly see is the Bondi time elapses initially very slowly, and at the end of the calculation it blows up. It goes up very steep. And the dotted line is how proper time elapses for the central observer. That means the observer which is sitting at the throat, at the center of symmetry. So in the different resolution calculations I did, where did they stop? That is the 50 cube run, that's the 100 cube run, and that is the 125 cube run. I should also say that if one has something going on in the space-time, you would expect that in the interior as well as in the exterior, this flatter phase lasts longer, and this blow up comes later because you read I plus when everything has happened in the interior. The event horizons cross about here. So this is the proper time which was needed to integrate to where the event horizons cross, and this is what we did into the direction of the other singularity. So now I promise to say something about the error. In units of the mass, yeah.
So it's
7 approximately. So how accurate is the calculation? There are different ways, of course, a convergence analysis. What I want to show here is the curvature invariant I for the central observer, because at the point where the event horizons cross, that has a minimum. So this is plotted, the curvature invariant of the central observer. It goes down, it goes to a minimum, and goes slightly up again. I have plotted this minimal region here again and subtracted 3/2 because that is the correct value at the point where the event horizons cross. That means that here we are off by 1%. All other quantities, for example, that I integrate the null geodesic on scry and look at the value of omega at the location of this null geodesic, indicate the same size of the error for our quantities. This, of course, is a curvature quantity, this I. So, okay, so come to the conclusion. I hope I could show you that the conformal techniques allow to evolve initial data even for more complicated situations like black holes without the need to introduce any artificial boundary. And furthermore, due to the properties of the conformal equations, on all grid points which represent physical space-time, the solution converges to a solution of the Einstein equation, no matter what we do on the grid boundary, as long as the grid boundary is stable in the numerical sense. Okay.
What?
install or gauge conditions such as some Asian people might use. Will that interfere with the regularity, some formal regularity, or?
So if you do something like this, then the character of the equations changes in the general case. That means you no longer have the metric hyperbolic equations, because the time evolution equations contain second derivatives of of Q and lab and shift, and first derivatives of the Ricci scalar. I know that Jörg Fraundiener has tried something like this in the 2D case, where he used the A3 solution, took the gauge source function from the A3 solution, and evolved it without any problem. And then he introduced a condition which is something like maximal slicing, where the K, where you give Q as a function of the extrinsic curvature, and immediately the code became unstable. Because if you do this, you no longer have a symmetric hyperbolic equation, and then obviously the discretization does no longer allow you to do so. I should say that I don't know what it is the case in the here, because in the fourth order scheme, Björk uses a second order scheme. I also tried certain gauge choices where I try to connect the Q here, to relate those two here in a different way, to ensure something like that the light cone has a constant area when intersected, and that this also becomes unstable. Because if you look at it, you immediately see that the gauge, that these equations are no longer symmetric hyperbolic. I tried, it's well known what you have to do with the shift to fix Gry. So essentially, the shift must be proportional to the derivative of omega, the space-like derivative of omega. If you write down the conformal field equations in the tetrad formalism, you can do so without using symmetric hyperbolicity. In my formulation, you cannot, and when I try this, the code becomes unstable. So what I have to do is do a time evolution, look what the gradient of omega does, go back, prescribe the shift as a function which I have guessed from the numerical solution, run, and then this is stable, and then do this iterative scheme. And that is why I say I have almost control over Scry, because by doing this procedure, Scry will slightly move around, but not much.
One problem with these conformal techniques is, of course, that they tend to kill off places where things are happening, and so things start happening faster and faster.
No.
In this coordinate system.
No. That depends on the gauge you choose.
In waves traveling out, for example, tend to get squished closer and closer.
No.
This is between all the
coordinates. That's a usual error. That's not correct. I mean, if you prove a theory, things exist. They exist.
No, but what exists mathematically and what is useful numerically are not necessarily the same
thing. In the usual...
I'm not saying that this doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So, already in the...
I'm saying that as far as using it as a numerical technique...
All kinds of freedoms is a conformal gauge. If you feel that there's something going on, you can change it.
So, if you look at wave propagation problem in the conformal picture of Minkowski, what you get is the wave comes in here and goes out here. So you had all over the place, you have the same resolution to represent the wave. I think what happens if you compactify the space-like surface only, then you get exactly what you described. But here the compactification is done for the 4 metric, and therefore this does not happen. So what you throw out by compactifying along the null directions here is just the trivial fall off. A wave, a physical wave, behaves like...
You do have facts, Kevin.
Yeah. Then you get this
you
here.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
And then you have orb. I mean, these things orbit in proper time.
What you can do is, so if you have the feeling that, okay, if you have the feeling that your evolution lasts forever, so that you don't have a regular I plus, what you can do is you use a gauge where scry is this line here, and you do not compactify in time direction, then your black holes just move like this, and your waves propagate like this. And in principle, that runs forever with the same resolution. So it depends on what problem you want to solve, what is the best choice of gauge. If I could, in this first picture I drawed, this is very well tuned to read off fall-off behavior for waves. For example, in the spherical symmetric case, I could read off the backscatter fall-off behavior of a scalar wave equation to 10 to the 6 times the mass of the initial data. And when a black hole forms, I could do that to 10 to the 5 times the mass of the initial data. Pardon?
10 to the minus 5.
The proper time was 10 to the 5 times the ADM mass in the black hole case, and 10 to the 6 in the normal case. I just in 3D I do not come that far, because here I have much I can use for those calculations. I used 5 and 10,000 grid points.
For example, in this one, everything is squished down to something like 1 m worth of time. And the amount of time that you could resolve in the diagram that you had there looked to me like a few m.
Yeah, but
and then everything that happens over a longer time scale just gets all squeezed down into some tiny little region.
No, because if something is going on in the space-time, which takes a longer time, so where's the diagram? So this, the conformal field equations take care of that as long as something is going on in the space-time, you have a behavior like this. And when you are coming close to I plus, then things start blowing up.
I don't know what you mean by coming close to I plus, because I plus isn't, how do you come close to infinity?
So if you calculate this, so here in this picture, let's assume we would have the exact Gauss function. What would happen if we integrate this picture up? What will happen is that certain quantities start blowing up when we approach the surface here, because that's a singularity.
The real question is that there's a lot of interesting things happening as you get near the volume plus, which doesn't seem to be resolved if you have a grid that's roughly uniform in the crustal system.
No.
How would you handle two black holes or two stars or something? Let's say fluid stars.
I use a shift which fixes scry here. Then these grid points here are used for representing physical space-time. Scry stays at a constant grid, almost constant grid point value, so the resolution here is the same. And then, of course, I have to do a long time integration here.
So how would that map back onto the Kruskal diagram?
In the Kruskal diagram, actually, I can show you, see that this is happening in this picture here. What's happening here is, in this picture, if you look careful at it, what you see is that in this time evolution, the light tones here become steeper and steeper. So we have very strong indication that if we choose a Ricci scalar, which is finite for all coordinate values, we eventually end up with a situation where the event horizons just propagate upwards, scry just propagates upwards, and everything more or less freezes, because the light cones just are straight lines, or almost collapsed
really
light cones.
In your system, in that diagram there, you've got, you know, 3 or 4 grid points, and that's totally useless for describing any physics. You know, I mean, even if it does get forced, if that region becomes too small, then that...
So whatever you can describe as feature on the initial slice, I can also read off as scribe.
Not with finite resolution.
Yeah. So with a good choice of shift, this blue line would just move up straight. So the number of grid points. I don't know.
And I'm not saying that the technique is useless or anything, but I'm just trying, you know.
You don't need to compactify in the time direction.
How do you decide which to do?
That's by the choice of shift.
Peter, you said if you didn't compactify time, you wouldn't have
two
choices, didn't you? If you don't compactify the time, if you just compactify in R, don't you then have problems with the wave, losing resolution?
No, because the light cones still travel like this here.
The wave phases are constant along the light cones.
Yeah.
Well, we wish they were.
Of course, with a bad choice of gauge source functions, the light cone will squeeze together, go apart and again, so it's not exactly constant.
The light cones are still in from both sides?
No, here in this choice here, the light cones would all just look like this here. And it's this at the edge here, the light cone is this here. I guess some gauge source function. I just use it for the initial data.
And the reason you're claiming that you can't use the foliation of the table constant flight is so that they go up nicely so that the derivatives of the alpha would mess up your.
Yeah. So what you can do, of course, is do a time evolution for some time, look at the values which you would need to approximately keep the k-equal constant hypersurface, and then redo the calculation with the same gauge loss functions.
Okay, so then on the Kruskal diagram, if you start with the
I cannot tell you what it looks like. Yeah, I could in principle, though you can't. Of course, if you are interested in what happens on Scry, then if you have a slicing which stays away from the singularity and approaches it first here, then that's a very good choice.
Right. That's so. What I know what it's like about.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, I mean, it's a shame because I always thought it would be a great slicing. That's why we did all these different kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Around the alpha.
I think the challenge would be to, if you want a live black chip, you can't put them in with elliptic equations because that will destroy the whole system. So the challenge would be to see if you could find some hyperbolic equations containing enough damping that they would sort of stay in the neighborhood of what you would like. And if that's possible, it might still be a well closed system.
I mean, if it really has been an urgent. I do not think the principle is positive to do it.
this very complete the idea.
Yeah.
So that's what I do here.
Last.
Yeah, I wanted to such a negative something about the carbonic system. I think it's probably sensitive to the to what elliptic system you use.
Right.
Because the system has the right properties to tie to the hyperbolic form. But I think I would think there are such properties. I think that one should look more closely.
Yeah, and this would be wonderful if you could get this. There's so much of the power of the theoretical structure that all along the
systems, but doesn't face up to the informal regularity issue which you have in addition. So I guess my first question, which is related to some of these other things, is do you mess up not just the hyperbolicity, which might be okay because you replace it by hyperbolic elliptic, but also the conformal regularity of the scheme by going to something like mixing these elliptic?
The problem seems to fit the different way. Related to this session, but I do not think it excludes this principle. But it requires.
I can't see why it would, because the whole point of, like you use the hyperbolic constant slice to start with, because it had very nice properties, right? It had very nice properties, and it was okay to be in their system to start with. Well, why wouldn't a bunch more of them be okay? To the future, right? It'd just be a more generally and more complicated mathematical generalization.
Actually, I think if you want to choose trace K equal constant slice where trace K means the conformal K, then I think it would be the same equation as in physical space-time. It's just if you want to enforce in the conformal space-time to have a trace physical K equal constant, then you get probably an elliptic equation which has the same principal part or similar principal part as the Amabi equation.
But you said that's no problem. In fact,
I wouldn't say it that way. I know what to do then in this case, but I wouldn't say that it didn't cause me difficulty.
Yeah, less of it, but you have the same principal part, but at least it's linear, which where you were facing.
Normally, what you use is line elastic chips in order to return this frozen elastic chip that you're troubled. But he can evolve all the way. So why should he change? Right? I agree for complete sense of mathematics and everything. I'm taking Bernie's viewpoint, basically. I mean, he's working fine. And there are priorities.
Well, fine and Schwarzschild.
Yeah.
What was your choice of last?
No, but what part of
it? Go to the next problem.
I mean, I think you here also, yeah, no. He did not take it analytically. He just made a guess, the educated guess or not. I agree the burden is on him, but again, in Bernie's study, he should do exactly the same. He should do some, you know, backup guesses. And if it fails, then one can go to this. What's wrong with that?
This was always my philosophy, you were saying.
Okay.
And maybe I shouldn't say anything again. But I mean, if one could make it automatic, it's what you do.
I agree.
Right. If one theories which ensure that this kind of
No,
I guess to phrase my question a different way, I mean, we know from all of these singularity avoidance slicing that you always run into this problem of the the coordinate grid stretching of right near the horizon. Why doesn't this procedure run you into exactly the same problem?
I think the reason is because in conformal time, you have the same, about the same order of time to elapse in the interior as well as in the exterior. And if you go to physical space-time, you have in the exterior, you have an infinite time to go, and in the interior, you can only go a finite time. So the hypersurfaces in the physical space-time run apart, and in the conformal, they don't. But I think it would be interesting if one could get a physical slice or and transform it to the conformal picture to see what it looks like in the conformal picture. So I mean a slice which has this grid stretching property.
Something has to blow up, so I guess what you're saying is that omega blows up on this.
Yeah, it's a singularity. So, if you just choose a different shift, you may not come up with this, but what you always can do is just break down the time evolution in the interior. And so, just because, in, as I erased it, you have here the conformal time here has no physical meaning.
Yeah, no,
I would not expect this to happen in this case here.
So you have more trouble with
I don't think so. I don't think that I have much more, I have stretching in this case here, but it's, one needs to see that.
Have you, and again, tell me if you did this one with us, have you done any of the gravitational grid, I mean, astronomical blast, either weak real waves or
what?
To see what the waves look like from a, not from a, one of these, you know, no. things, but
what I have done is some fast time evolution of the A3-like space-times, which are gravitational waves but have a different topology. I have not done it for the Schwarzschild or Brill wave case because I don't have an initial data solver for those at the moment.
Maybe it would be helpful to just say, well, in a sense, the series basic topology.
So, yeah. So, the A3 topology is.
But
the A3 topology is that you have two scribes here, like in the Schwarzschild case, and you identify those boundaries periodically, and you have an open boundary which lets you go to infinity in this direction. So this is a two torus in the three-dimensional picture, in contrast to the sphere in the Schwarzschild picture. Actually, if you take polar coordinates, Schwarzschild looks pretty much like this.
One thing I could suggest, and Saul can tell me if this is wrong, but Saul developed an analytic linear real wave. Therefore, you could just take a constant, probably analytically, for the given Minkowski space and slice it and then project that solution onto your initial data. And then you'd have the initial data, but they would still have the property that there's a, you know, it's like a clump of radiation in the middle because it's where the intersection is from time-symmetric wave.
And then that's only the linear. I mean,
sure, it's only linear. But the point is, what it would do is it would get this issue of, if you have enough grid points, or what Bill said, if you have enough grid points to do good resolution, sort of at the bottom of the hyperboloid where the stuff is, you know, has minimum spatial extent, and then it just, if the speed of light goes out, then you'd be able to answer quickly whether or not there's any problem in terms of resolving the waves as they head out to scry. It's all analytics, so you can send in Minkowski space, so you have a control over everything.
So I don't know these data sets.
Just when you solve the linear wave equation for you know, superposition.
Right. a finite amount
of inflowing waves so that you get everywhere regular in Minkowski space, and then you can get an outgoing wave.
Yeah. I have to look at this. The problem which appears in if you try to transform something from physical space time to conformal space time is usually that you have to find the conformal factor. That is this technical difficulty when doing this. But I did in the spherical symmetric run, I did do scalar wave coupled to Einstein's equations, and I didn't have that resolution problem. So I. There you. So there's this issue about So there is a difference. If you start with regular data, then that means with data which are R3, then what you have essentially this situation here. And what you do then, you form a black hole, and then you have a singularity sitting here like this, and you have an event horizon with caustics. So you have formed, in a certain sense, two black holes. The point is that the topology is conserved under time evolution. So this is the situation if you start with regular data. If you start with two black holes, then I cannot draw this in such a simple picture, but you start with a situation like this here, which has a completely different topology, and there you will have, of course, an event horizon for this guy here, which probably looks pretty similar to this one here, but you also have event horizons for the other scribes.
In the science article that you read on the detailed structure of the horizons of the black hole, we took what Stu Shapiro and Saul had done, which is to use a relatively star collapse to view the matter created as the black holes and then collided.
I can do that here. Mm-hmm. That's just the issue of solving the initial data, getting initial data, mm-hmm. which is, I don't have a solver for this situation, which in this is just in this picture, this situation here, and I don't have a solver for this situation here, and I guess the solver for this is not very difficult because you use polar coordinates, and then you in polar coordinates you can essentially do the same thing I had here, because in polar coordinates this is at constant r, or you can arrange things that this is at constant r. I just didn't have the time to write that, so I think if someone gives me data we can just start and evolve it.
You described solving the Hamiltonian constraint to the Samadhi equation on the initial slice, as I recall, but I may have just missed it, but how well does your propagation conserve the constraint? You don't resolve the Hamiltonian constraint.
So what I see in this Schwarzschild run, for example, I have not evaluated the constraints at the very last moment, but after about 80% of the time, and the violation grows by a factor of 10 approximately. So it differs what constraint you look at, but it grows, but not very dramatic, and it scales down with if you go to a smaller grid, it essentially scales down like expected from the convergence order of the scheme.
But what if either you or maybe other people work on this would that for the rest of the people? Just quickly, someone compare and contrast your evolution of a single black hole and other people. Stable evolution of single black holes. I think we all talk about it separate parts of our heads.
Why don't we do this as a homework exercise? I mean, if you can actually get slices, first of all,
is some qualitative statement that you want to make. I think that's the detail answer would have been one. Oxygen problem. I was going to pluses and minuses, so the pluses would be no oxygen problem, the minuses would be exactly what you're saying just now. Finding good slice on which you can specify initial data.
No, but I mean, yeah, but I think Rev's first is saying it's not obvious that there is no oxygen problem. I mean, there isn't the Schwarzschild, but there might be.
No, but I mean, I meant oxygen problem in the standard sense of the word that was used before. Not much intuition.
Right. Every other thing could borrow from the techniques that are have already been created or used by 3+1 and inserts, then in the partition, ever in this case, we can just go and try to get something that is already working in the art, so in this case, and it should work. This translation works, but I mean, he can borrow a lot from whatever 3+1 is already.
First Bob, then Carsten.
Oh, I was just saying that maybe it would be helpful to say why it's more difficult to get initial data.
I think if you look at the general problem of tabulating initial data, the only thing which is more complicated is that you need to know where the boundary there is. You cannot charge here for conditions based on off like 1/r or so in my data. So your solver must be such that know where it is, but besides that, the equations you have to solve are very similar. And so the point is just that for getting initial data for the conformal field equation, some people have looked into it for some time to prove that they exist, but there was no work done in the sense of, or not much done in the sense that how to construct data out of it. So if you look how many papers have been published about initial data problems for physical space time. So you can just go into this book, take a dictionary, pick out the paper.
Yes.
I want to say that the reason for saying no man is just from the absolute reason for the narrative, but that's going to be the problem.
But I have this stable auto boundary that
Fujia will contribute to the solution in the interior, but what I do, but the dependence is a stable rate, that means it's dependent convergence of rate. So it contributes to the discretization error in the same way as the interior contributes to the discretization error. And actually, I see that you have a contribution from here, that if I change the treatment here or the interior thing here, the solution will subside here. But you also have to take into account for this 125 group run, there are 5,500 time steps. So that, I think that's quite a lot. If I can cure this issue with the an isotopy of the initial light cone and then use larger time steps, I can go there much faster. At least it's been the reason for the small time steps.
Okay, the last comment, Tanya.
Can you tell me what you expect to happen if you put in a scalar wave in such a way that it was going to form a black hole in the center? How would your factor show that the black hole is formed?
So, what happened in the circuit in the case, and I assume that at least near circuit symmetry is the same as we do. What you get here is a situation like this. You have a similarity here, which looks like this. And if the black hole is smaller, so if you are near, in the critical value, the similarity looks more like this.
So
it's more, it's longer along the event horizon, so this is the event horizon.
But this is the space-time diagram in the conformal.
In the conformal picture, yeah.
If you started drawing these pictures like your initial conditions, where you sketched out a boundary where omega was equal to zero, representing the initial infinity, would you get another omega equal to zero region appearing in the center of the black hole formed?
No, only in the exceptional cases.
Ah, okay. From the light ray.
Yeah.
From the light.
Actually, what I see is, I get it in one case that I did prepare the symmetric run, and that was, I get it in the limit of the critical solution. So the critical solution has an omega equal to zero here, and has an omega equal to zero here. But I must say, omega depends on the gauge, and I don't know what happens if I change the gauge, because in the symmetric code, the energy is fixed, so it cannot change.
So do you recognize that you form a hole?
How
do you recognize that you have formed a hole?
Because I find a parallel horizon. Mm-hmm. Because I find a singularity here, blow up or further current, and I find a regular horizon.
I think we should thank Peter again. Let's